I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Health Today with Good Samaritan Hospital. We're joined by Dr. Robert Perutka, who is with the Johns Hopkins Orthopedics and Spine Surgery at Good Samaritan Hospital. And something that all of us have, we're going to talk about today, is our back pain, doctor. This is a really universal issue, isn't it?
You're right. About 80% of Americans experience back pain sometime during their life. So it's a very, very common experience.
And it's not one thing that causes it. I mean, this can be a plethora of things that happen to us that create back pain.
That's correct.
And so, I mean, what should we know if 80% of us get this? I mean, how do we know when there's just a little twist in our back, we're not feeling well, or when we should call a physician? Or how do we determine that?
Well, that's a good question. Typically, patients will try whatever is necessary on their own to treat back pain, and it can consist of simple things like bed rest, restriction of activities, avoiding activities that cause back pain, using over-the-counter analgesics like Tylenol or ibuprofen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine as long as the pain resides. If the pain persists, that's a situation where they should seek medical evaluation. There are other times when perhaps serious back conditions can occur where patients should also seek immediate medical evaluation. That would include severe pain, severe leg pain, perhaps fever or chills associated with back pain, and a very extreme and unusual situation where patients could lose control of their bowel or bladder.
Oh, really? All those complexities are going to arise out of certain kinds of back pain?
They can for some serious issues.
You always hear people talking about surgery with their backs, and people are very fearful of that. It's maybe one of the scariest surgeries for most people to contemplate.
Well, that can be true, but the fact is the vast majority of these back issues can be treated non-operatively.
As in? I mean, what does that mean? How does that work?
Well, there's an approach to back pain that we usually take, starting with the most conservative measures and continuing on to see if the back pain can be treated successfully. That would consist of the medications. It could consist of physical therapy or even a home exercise program for patients to teach them how to stretch the back muscles, how to strengthen the back muscles. It could consist of injections. So there's a whole sort of armamentarium of treatment options that we go through, and they're all based on the patient's diagnosis and cause of the back pain. When we get to situations where there is perhaps some physical reason that cannot be treated non-operatively, such as a huge herniated disc pressing on the nerves or the spinal cord, that's when we're talking about surgical treatment. Or when patients exhaust all the non-operative treatments and have pain that interferes with their normal activity, that's when we talk about surgical options.
And that's what you go through first before you even go to surgery, unless there's something really ruptured or wrong that you discover.
That's true.
So talk about the Spine Center at Good Sam and what makes that place, from your perspective, so unique.
The Spine Center at Good Samaritan Hospital has a comprehensive approach to back pain. You can think of it as one-stop shopping, if you will. Patients can contact the Spine Center, and a nurse coordinator will basically triage that patient, have the patient evaluate it, and point the patient in the right direction. So if a patient would most appropriately be treated by non-operative measures, that patient may perhaps see a physiatrist who's a physician who treats back pain and other musculoskeletal conditions with non-operative treatment. Physical therapy may be arranged. If it's unclear, the patient will have an appointment made with an orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon for evaluation. And certainly if there are situations that possibly are surgical, that patient will first see a physician who would consider the surgery.
That's a really comprehensive, the way you're describing the center. So, I mean, I think it's important because people, as I said earlier, have a great fear about back surgery and what happens, and the idea that you have a center that can bring all these different people to come to bear on a patient and help is a kind of thing pretty unique and very important.
I agree. And patients shouldn't be afraid of it. You know, seeking medical care for an issue like that is important. So I wouldn't ignore back pain that goes on and on. There's lots of help and lots of treatment options.
Dr. Robert Perutka, has been great talking to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
For more information about the Spine Center at Good Samaritan Hospital, call 443-444-4142 or visit goodsam-md.org. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and most of us heard or saw President Barack Obama speak last night, State of the Union. We have gathered a panel of some interesting people here to talk about that State of the Union speech. Later in the program, we are going to play the last part of our show today, for the last half an hour, is a tribute to Howard Zinn, who was on the show last in November. He wrote The People's History of the United States. He was one of the greatest men of our nation, at least from my perspective. His book is one that we always give out to our friends and people we care about to read. Let me give you an example of what he does, and then we'll jump into our show. Howard Zinn, when he writes his book, when he looks at the Constitution and the constitutional era, he looks at it through the eyes of the slaves. When he talks about Andrew Jackson, President Andrew Jackson, he looks at it through the eyes of the Cherokees and the tribes that were displaced. When he looks at the industrialists and factory owners of America in the late 18th, early 19th century, he sees it through the eyes of the women workers who were enslaved in those factories. That's how he sees history from the people's perspective, and was an activist and a scholar. And I first encountered him in the early 1960s when I was a young civil rights worker, a teenager. And he wrote a book called The New Abolitionist, which was the story of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It really grabbed me. And I've just been reading everything he's written and followed him all those years. And his son and I were in theater and college together way back in another age. And he passed away last night. I have a heart attack at 87. And we're working to replay our last interview with him of the four we've done. And the rest of those interviews will be up on the website in the next day or so. Maybe they're now, as far as I know. but we want to start with that. Now, we were going to present today a interview with Medea Benjamin, who was a peace activist who co-founded Code Pink and the Global Exchange. But because of Howard Zinn's passing, we're playing his memorial piece at the end of these 2 hours. But we want to remind you that Medea Benjamin will be in Baltimore. She'll be speaking in Baltimore this Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m. at 2640 St. Paul Street. We interviewed her yesterday when she was in Haiti working with her Global Exchange. And I want to start this program off with a clip of her discussing President Barack Obama's first year in office. And again, to hear the whole interview, you can go to our website, steinershow.org. But let's listen to this and then introduce our guests and start our discussion about the State of the Union.
I'm extremely disappointed in Obama's first year. I expected a lot more. I feel like whether we're talking about the economy, where he has been doing the same kind of policies as under the Bush administration of supporting Wall Street and not really focusing on the most important things in the economy, like jobs, or whether we're talking about intensifying the wars that he inherited, or even issues about civil liberties, not being able to close Guantanamo, stop extraordinary renditions, guarantee that people being held by the United States would be allowed to have due process. In all of these areas, I feel disappointed. And when I reflect on it, it's not only a disappointment in Obama, but it's a disappointment certainly in the Democratic Party that controls the Congress and the White House.
That was a comment by Medea Benjamin, and we'll be hearing a lot more from Barack Obama and clips from his speech last night. In the studio with me are Anthony McCarthy, of course, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show, here every Friday in the afternoon of 5 to 7 p.m. Mary Washington is with us. She is a Maryland Democratic State Central Committee member for the 43rd Legislative District and a member of the Baltimore City Sustainability Commission. The Reverend Heber Brown is the servant leader, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore over on Belvedere. And Bob Summerby is with us. He's editor of the Daily Howler. And Bob's new website is How He Got There and explores how George W. Bush became president of this United States of America. Welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
And we look forward to you all joining us at 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts on the State of the Union speech last night? We're dying to hear your ideas. But what did you all think? I mean, I let me throw out an idea, and then you can just jump at it. I mean, I looked at it, and when we finished watching it, Valerie said, "What did you think?" And I said, "Well, you know, I think that I thought A, that he made a speech that spoke to his supporters who may be disenchanted with him. They may become to bring them back in, trying to bring the independents back in, trying to set himself up and explain to the country why he's a reasonable human being and how he thinks, to lay it out fairly to the people about where the deficit was and where things are going." And I thought in many ways it was a very moderate speech, the speech of a moderate man. And I'm curious what you all think about the speech and how effective you think it was. And let me begin with
Heber Brown, since this is welcome. It's the first time on our show.
Yes,
it won't be
thank
the last.
You.
Good to have you here. So, Heber, please, why don't you start us off?
Well, thanks so much, Mark. I think that that was a speech of a modern. I think that over his political life, President Obama has shown that ability to pull in different groups of people. As I was analyzing his speech, what I think one of the things that he does masterfully, he uses narrative mm-hmm. to communicate, I get it, I identify with you, I even if I don't agree with you, I understand what you're feeling right now. Even a few minutes into his speech, he talks about, you know, Americans, they don't understand why it seems like bad behavior on Wall Street is rewarded. He actually takes on the persona of those, you know he's not feeling it, you know, like we're feeling it. But he takes on the persona of those who are really under the rock of this experience and sends some assurances using narrative throughout. And so I think he's masterful in doing that and using that to bring people together.
And then I
Mary Washington.
I actually think that it's right that we're going to end this program, with a commemoration of Howard Zinn and a people's history, because clearly we have a president. One of the things I love about this president is that he is constantly reminding us of our history and where we came from. But if I could reflect for a minute on what Ms. Benjamin said and sort of get at the disappointment, I think what he did accomplish in the speech was to reassert his commitment to green jobs. He actually spoke to that, reassert his commitment to ending poverty. I mean, one of the things I noticed is that I don't think I've heard the words ending poverty or anti-poverty in a State of Union address. So I think that was meaningful to improving education, expanding and protecting equal rights. But I think what we wanted to hear was a date to the end of ENDA, a repeal of DOMA, the extension of right of marriage, protection of against hate crimes. I think we wanted to hear a clear date of when we were going to get out of Guantanamo. I think people wanted to hear that as well. So, but I think that what he did recognize in one of his statements was that he accepts that change has not come as soon as we'd like it to come. So, I definitely understand the disappointment. I don't see this as a moderate president. I do think I see it as a maturing president, and I don't think he's abandoned his ideas, because, in fact, there were a number of times when he said he has not quit and he's going to continue. But I think he's challenging us to be partners in this.
Bob Somerville.
Yeah, I guess the first thing I thought watching the speech was this was an event that would remind people of why they're inclined to want to respect, admire, like Barack Obama. People do respect, admire, and like are very strongly inclined to, although there's been a lot of disappointment lately and disillusionment, although thinking it over, I'll say this, it's only found in three places on the left, the right, and the center, so that's the good news. everyone's been mad lately. On the other hand, from my perspective, his approval ratings remain almost amazingly high given the disastrous economic times in which he's serving. I thought last night a lot of people have heard a lot of disillusionment aimed at Obama in the last month, let's say. I thought last night was a chance to remember why people want to believe in this guy and why people are very strongly inclined to admire and respect him. Aside from that, I must say, watching the speech, what I'm struck by is just the massive dysfunction of our system. It's got nothing to do with him. I mean, if he were sent here by Moses, he would still have this mountain of dysfunction, he or anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't think there was anything in particular he could have said last night that would have unlocked this ridiculous situation we're in as a society. I think they're doing a pretty good job sidestepping the awkwardness of what's happened to healthcare. It sounds like they're looking for a way to proceed, and they haven't quite decided what to do. I hope they figure something out, and I hope they do proceed. It sounds like the Congress might be deciding we're just going to show a little guts this time and just go on and try to do this. There are ways they could do it. I think that would be a very good thing for Democrats to do for once. I don't know why Medea Benjamin was disappointed in the Democratic Party. I don't know what she thought she was going to get from the not to be unkind, but it's not a particularly fire-breathing party. So I don't know. I thought last night this was a chance for Obama to say to people again, remember me? I think, remember me, you kind of, you know, I'm someone you might want to stick with. And I hope that they come up with some stuff in the next few weeks that starts to make people feel that some progress is going on. People, let's say, in the Democratic Party and on the left, for example.
Anthony.
Well, at the risk, of repeating everything that your three previous guests have said, I mean, they've touched on almost all the issues. I will say two things. I think that Barack Obama walked a very fine line yesterday. We did not see the soaring rhetoric and lofty oratory that we've come to expect from Barack Obama. There were moments of great passion. Mm-hmm. There were moments of intense emotion. But mostly it was a very relaxed and reserved president speaking to the fears and disappointments of the American people. Mark, you mentioned the constituencies. I think he did. It was a long speech. It was over 70 minutes. He hit everything. As an observant and analyst, I have to tell you, I grow very weary of people like Medea Benjamin, who run off this litany of things that they are disappointed. I don't know who could have done all the things that she listed in their first year in office. I know that the expectations of the left were extraordinarily high. Many of them had signed on to a much more moderate Hillary Clinton. They had great hope and expectation that Barack Obama would come in after 8 years and move an entire mountain in the course of 12 months. He cannot do it. And given that we saw what he's up against, not only the disappointment, he spoke to it, of the American people, an opposition party, the Republican Party, that is determined, no matter what the issue is, whether it's goldfish for every child in America, whatever the issue is, they are going to say no. And we saw it on their faces. He talked about tax cuts for the middle class. He talked about giving people, college students, a break on their loan. And he could not get a smile out of that party.
Well, that was one of the things that was funny when he talked about the taxes. He said, I thought I'd get
I would get something, a little applause from you guys.
Well, that's what's one of the fun things, again, that I admire and love about this president, is that there are these jokes. And so, you know, we're kind of talking about the heavy things, but it was really, I thought, masterful in the way in which he sort of would take these occasions to sort of bring humor and levity and honesty, and again, make us fall in love with him again. And just why I wanted to get into the habit of actually honoring the disappointed, because again, I find myself often in these contexts really advocating and really seeing the sort of the bright side. I want to honor and understand that, you know, and I believe that what we heard was kind of a modulated approach to encouraging us and inspiring us. I mean, he brought us to a place where we, you know, could feel good about, particularly starting right off in the speech, feel good about our history, and then get right down to the fact that there are many people who are unemployed, that we're still having devastating issues. And I think what we're going to see in the next 3 years is that encouraging, but not taking us so far off that when he doesn't hit it, we fall so quickly.
But he did fall flat several times, and I was very disappointed sometimes, because I've come to expect this man to just grab my heart and take it soaring every time he speaks. And I unlike Pastor Brown, who's one of my favorite people, has been on my show many times, Mark. But
fine.
What I would say is that I was not taken so much with the narratives. I was not taken so much with the letters from the children. And I wasn't taken so much with all of that, as much as I needed answers. I needed a plan. And I got that. And I was on Facebook the whole night talking to people all over the country. But they wanted him to draw lines, and they were disappointed. Now, he did take on Congress. He took on his party. He talked about bipartisanship, but then he would ridicule the Republicans about budgeting. He'd ridicule the Republicans about other issues. So, there were times when I thought that, as Dr. Washington said, he was maturing. There were the times when I saw immaturity in our president.
But then he took on the Supreme Court.
Right.
In their faces.
Yeah. And again, so there were these risky moments in that speech that were pushing the edge of what we typically see from a head of state.
So what do our listeners think at 410-319-8888 about what they heard last night from President Barack Obama? Were you happy with the speech? Did it change your mindset about him? Did you think he had gone too far? Think he didn't go far enough? I want to talk about many of the things he talked about last night, but he said to the Republicans, what he said to the Democrats, what he said to the court, what he said about opening the United States Armed Forces to people who will be open, who are openly gay, and saying you're welcome to the armed forces, which was a huge step to make for any president. What do you think about all that? Healthcare, 410-319-8888. Let's get your thoughts. We'll play some clips in a few minutes as soon as we're up and ready. We have Kirk in your car. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
You know, Mark, I want to change the question a little bit and,
sure.
and maybe ask, what did we learn from the speech last night? Because okay. I'm a loyal supporter, and I think that Barack has always told us that he would level with us. And last night was, I think, an excellent example of him just really being painfully honest with the American people. And the other thing, I guess, that I learned was that, you know, this is not going to be easy. This is a hard-fought effort on his part to reform what he said last night took 8 years to undo. So as he said in his speech, you know, he inherited trillions of dollars in debt and other really insurmountable, seemingly insurmountable problems before he even, you know, took the oath. So it's going to take radical initiatives and to undo some of these things. And I think those who claimed at one point or another that they supported him need to sort of, you know, re-examine where they are with regard to their own beliefs, political philosophies and what have you, so that we don't begin to undermine indirectly what we know is good for the American people, because I believe he's still true to what he's always espoused. And so, you know, in closing, I just want to say that if we are truly behind him and support what he initially presented to us, mm-hmm. then we need to be very careful in our critique of him and let this sort of run its course. I think, you know, I'm sorry, I forget your name.
My name is Mark.
No, not Mark, but just who spoke previously.
Anthony?
I appreciate that. My job is not to support the president, however. My job is to critique the president.
Well,
I'll let others support him.
On the one hand, Anthony, you love the president, and then on the other hand, you're critiquing him. And I say, you know, you can't do both.
Well, watch me do both. Watch me do both.
We have to do both. I mean, I think that this is going to be the interesting and challenging thing to us as progressives in this moment, this opportunity, is to continue to challenge power, but to do it constructively. And I think that's what we're looking for, and that's what we are demanding or requiring of conservatives or those that might disagree with us.
Heber?
Yeah, I would say that actually I agree with Anthony on the piece about loving and critiquing. I've never really been as high on President Obama as some others have been. And anybody read my blog and Facebook,
that's right.
I let it be known.
For sure.
But when I read his speech, and actually I have to read his speeches. I don't watch them. Because when I watch them, as a preacher, you know, I'm looking at the science and the art of communication,
right.
And he's masterful at that. And so I can't watch him. When I read his speeches, you know, I get a different picture of him. And so when I read his narrative and how he uses it, it was just me admiring the art of communication. But in the same sentence, I can critique him, because when he talks about how he's going to, you know, freeze government spending, but not the military, not the Pentagon. See, I think progressives need to be very clear. This is not a peace president, and sometimes we might get tripped up in that. But when he says, I'm going to freeze government, so I'm going to freeze the money for your schools, your libraries, your roads, your local government, but the military, we're going to leave that money alone. And for me, I just raises the question, why does it seem to be foregone social wisdom that it is right to continue to build this military this Pentagon, this military system, when, you know, Dr. King, who this president echoes King in almost everything he says in so many different ways, said that that's one of the triple evils of our society, militarism. But this president's going to continue in building and expanding our military effort. And so I think progressives, it might be a moment for progressives also, as you talked about, Dr. Washington, to find out who they are. Who are you in light of this popular president who you like, who you love to go to, you know, grab dinner with, to go to see a movie with, but is still supporting policies that go against what progressives say is at the fabric of who they are.
I mean, there's no question the spending freeze this week just really cut it on among economists, progressive economists or liberal economists. It just produced tremendous negative feedback from people who understand economics in so many different ways. I've heard different explanations. Someone last night on TV, Jamie Galbraith, a University of Texas economist, was even speculating this was done so that the Senate wouldn't pass commission. I don't know. that's possible. But a lot of people have said, and it's really sort of accurate, that by repeating the language of the spending freeze and families are cutting back, so we have to cut back, that is just repeating Republican, conservative economic boilerplate. The arguments that have been made against progressive economic policy for decades, it's just repeating and validating against your own basic instincts. So that's an area where, people, and I must say, it's I understand it as a type of – I don't know what the motives were behind it.
Well, let's take a short break, and let's come right back from the break, Anthony, and pop into this. And we'll talk a bit about the economy. We're going to look at a couple of – here's some clips from the speech that are up and ready to roll. 410-319-8888. Dana and Sharon, the next two callers up. You can hold on. We'll come back to your calls after this break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back.
If we had taken office in ordinary times, I would have liked nothing more than to start bringing down the deficit. But we took office amid a crisis. And our efforts to prevent a second depression have added another $1 trillion to our national debt. That, too, is a fact. I'm absolutely convinced that was the right thing to do. But families across the country are tightening their belts and making tough decisions. The federal government should do the same.
That was a clip of President Barack Obama last night. We're going to talk about that clip. Who'll be talking about it are Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler, and the website How He Got There by President George Bush, the Reverend Heber Brown of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore, Dr. Mary Washington, who's a member of the State Central Committee, Democratic State Central Committee, from the 43rd Legislative District, Anthony McCarthy, host of the Anthony McCarthy Show, 410-319-8888. We were just talking about that while we were at break, is this question of the deficit. I mean, I heard everything he said, but I think this is what you were talking about, Bob, alluding to in your opening statements, just about how does America wrestle with these things, and is Barack Obama or anybody else kind of either ameliorating, pacifying, or calming the American people when it comes to what we face?
Well, I mean, the absurdity of some of this in terms of the deficit, and you know, as we look ahead now, you know, on the left, it's fashionable to kind of poo-poo this and say, oh, come on, this is Republican conservative boilerplate. But we are looking ahead to numbers that are just unlike any numbers we've ever had. And this is not Obama's doing. It's the situation. It's the storm that rolled in before he became president. But those numbers are there. They're unlike any numbers we've ever faced. And so here we were this week talking about setting up a commission to recommend things, an 18-member commission. It got voted down by the Senate because it didn't get 60 votes. It got 53 votes. That counts. That's a loss now when you get 53 out of more of our inanity.
Yes.
Here's more of our inanity. This is going to be an 18-member commission, 10 Democrats, 8 Republicans. Unless 14 of them agreed on proposals, they wouldn't be presented to the Congress to vote. What would make anyone think that 14 people – 8 of whom are Republicans, were going to agree on anything at this point. So the very idea of this strikes me as absurd. There's never going to be 10 Democrats and then 4 out of 8 Republicans agreeing on anything about the deficit. That's just absurd. So this is the situation we're in on every front. Nothing makes any sense. Our society, political society, is so polarized now, nothing makes sense.
We probably should do a show just about the rules of the United States Senate. Mind, folks, we just open the phones real fast and get folks in here.
No, absolutely.
410-319-8888. Dana in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to comment on the president's speech last night. One of the things that I thought was extremely helpful and something that I don't think we've seen in presidential speeches in a long, long time was the president taking responsibility for things that he hasn't done as well or as effectively in the last year. His, you know, direct comments about, you know, owning his responsibility related to not being clear about health care was one where I really respected him for doing that, because it's something that people may have been talking about, but he hadn't responded to or addressed. And I think that sort of comment helps increase his credibility with the American people. And for those things that, you know, we need to hear, even if we don't want to hear them, I thought it was very helpful. And thank you for taking my call.
Danny raised a point. What do you all think about that? I mean, I think that that's why I said in the very beginning of the show, I think this speech in some ways is reaching out to independent voters and his base of supporters in the beginning, whether it was young people, communities of color, progressives. What do we think about? Did he do that? Did he make that?
Well, I'll go ahead and say that I believe again. I continue to believe the practicality of things that are being laid out, that thinking about, you know, can 18 people agree about how we're going to deal with $1 trillion deficit? Of course not.
14 out of 18.
Okay.
Never.
Okay. 15.
Never.
15. But I do think this was an opportunity. To a certain extent, it's theater, right? It's an opportunity to kind of bring us back. I mean, to lay a framework, to set a challenge. And what I found exciting was that he challenged us to not be second in job creation. He talked about job creation and kind of feeding into American competitiveness. And I think he's experimenting with that. It's unfortunate that we're getting kind of Reagan-esque in the tightening of the belts, and we all have to do with a little less, and we absolutely have to make sure that we're not cutting in health care and support of education and things like that. That's our fight. Definitely in terms of laying out, you know, what we need to do, the challenges that are ahead, I think that's what this speech did.
I was just thinking, though, when I was thinking about what you were just saying, what President Barack Obama said, and others said that, I mean, it's even if progressives got their wish, and he cut the military budget back, okay, and brought the troops home from Afghanistan, and took that $1 billion and put it back into the United States of America to help rebuild the community, we'd still be in a mess, and we would still have to, what conservatives tell us we have to do, tighten our belts if we're serious about getting something done in America.
Well, I think that the picture he painted, Mark, I think you're so on to this, because I think that the president reminded us of where we realistically, practically, where we are. And guess what? It's going to hurt. And I found it fascinating that he reminded the Republican. But, you know, he really did speak past Congress last night. He was really speaking to the living rooms and the bars and all the places where people gather to watch this speech. He was talking to us last night over the heads of the members of Congress. I thought it was fascinating that when he talked about what he faced before he came into office, the cameras automatically went to John McCain. And he was speaking to Lindsey Graham saying, let's blame Bush. Yeah, that's it. Blame Bush.
Right.
Almost mocking the president. But we find ourselves in an extraordinary place. And this deficit, I mean, if we could get into, and I know we can't today, but if we could really get into the real intricate parts of what we face as a nation financially and who owns our nation, it would be frightening.
I think we wouldn't get up in the morning.
Yeah,
I mean,
it would
so
be overwhelming to families.
You absolutely have to have people that are on task and looking at it. But, you know, at a certain point, you just can't. You have to do one day at a time and just deal with what's in front of you.
And see, that's part of what I thought last night, what you mentioned, Mary, with the do we want to be number two stuff? You know, we're number – sort of that. That, to me, was also a bit of a classical American exceptionalism. We're number one.
That's right.
That sort of rallying cry has always pretty much worked in our politics because basically we've never been in this bad shape before. And just by the nature of the economic cycle, we've always come back to a reasonable position. Things have been getting worse for the middle class slowly over the last, let's say, 40 years. But we had mourning in America under Reagan. So this sort of rah-rah stuff is part of our basic politics. It's always worked out. I'm not sure it's going to work out this time. I mean, I'm not sure the traditional old, well, of course we'll come back. I'm not sure we're going to, unless someone comes up with some very good ideas and is able to persuade large segments of the population who are very negative on, I mean, we're in such a fragmented state now. The people who are just adamantly opposed to health care, you know, Obama has tried to explain health care. And people didn't take it. I mean, it's just that simple.
And there's this part in his speech where he says it's not inevitable. He talks about our progress and that some of us have thought that we've always progressed, and it's not inevitable. So
no.
He set us up earlier for that.
He, but then I'm going to go back to the phones here.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to touch on, as Bob and Mary were talking about, this American competitiveness and, you know, we don't want to be number two. They're just the first losers and that kind of good stuff, whatever. The spirit of that has home in American politics. But I don't always think it jives well with what the president is trying to convey when he is in other parts of the world. I mean, when you're talking about diplomacy and partnering and being together, arm in arm, working together for it, and then you come home and then you're talking about, you know, India needs us to do this, and he talks about this piece in the speech. He talks about India needs us here, and China needs, and these different places need us in different places, as if, you know, retreating back to that safe home of, you know, we are the ones that the world is waiting for. No. You know, you can't say one thing away and then come home and say something different. So I think I'd be sensitive about that, and it doesn't always jive too well.
410-319-8888. Doug, you're on the air.
I have just 2 points.
Sure.
On the issue of freezing government spending, I'm not reading what is being said this evening that he's freezing the Pentagon.
Or
I'm sorry, that he's not freezing the Pentagon.
No, he said that last night. We're not cutting defense.
He made exceptions.
Defense or security. That's right. He made several.
So, according to the Washington Post, national security. That's what I thought the language I read.
Yeah, that's defense spending.
Right, but I'm thinking national security. I'm thinking this is meaning the airports.
I think he's talking about
border crossing, National Guard. You know, they did defeat the prototype jet that was going to be billions to be built, and that's no longer in the Pentagon's budget.
Right.
So I think national security was what he was alluding to when he said, you know.
Okay, but I hear you, Doug. I don't think so. I think he's very clearly talking about defense spending. He might cut that program out because many people in the Pentagon thought that program was a waste of time. They were going to cut that anyway. It wasn't meeting muster, but I think he's very clear we're not cutting.
No, the freeze is on domestic discretionary spending. Now, by the way, mm-hmm. There's no guarantee this freeze is ever going to go into effect.
Not with the look on those Democrats' faces.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so that's the proposal was domestic discretionary spending.
What was your second point, Doug?
The Supreme Court, to me, just gave a large corporation a leg up by approving that additional contributions can be made to political campaigns. And I think the president did hit on that very hard because I'm in agreement with that. What the Supreme Court did was just giving the larger corporation, not the small business, more power to elect who they want in the Congress, in the Senate, and ultimately the White House.
Okay.
Anyone has a comment on that? I could.
Well,
thank you. Mary Washington.
A good friend of mine said that, you know, this whole government takeover of the healthcare industry or of healthcare was sort of a red herring for the actual takeover America, which is the corporate takeover, and sort of finalizing that. So while all of, you know, we were focused on the town halls and healthcare, all of this deliberation and testimony is going on in here. So, you know, I think we do have to be really mindful that these things that are being thrown at us to look at. So now we're looking at jobs. So perhaps we need to look at what isn't being talked about.
Let's hear what President Barack Obama had to say. We just heard the economy. Let's go to the next clip that you just put up.
To Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills. And if the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well. Just saying no to everything may be good short-term politics, but it's not leadership. We were sent here to serve our citizens, not our ambitions.
That was interesting. And one of the things was a New York Times CBS telephone poll conducted in December. And when you hear him say things like he said there, and they polled people again Wednesday and Thursday, the speech, 50% of the people approved the way the president was performing his job now. It's a little up. 39 disapprove. Over half of respondents said the economy was the most, and jobs were the most important issue. And 47% approved the president's handling, 43% disapproved that handling. So, I mean, I think that, you know, and take that and what he just said here and the kind of slap at the Republicans in a sense last night saying, you know, you can be obstructionist if you want, but you have to answer to the American people.
Well, no, they don't. I don't know that they do. But, I mean, those two little bites aimed at the two parties are interesting. You started up with saying to the Democrats, we have the largest majority in decades. No, we don't. That's an illusion, as long as the Republicans are going to insist on 60 votes. It doesn't matter if you have a 59-vote majority if it takes 60 votes to pass something. But so we're playing under a whole new set of rules now, here again. So that 59-vote majority may be larger than anyone else had, but suddenly the rules are different, and the rules are dysfunctional.
And it also isn't the case that all of these Democrats all have the same values and principles. So it's not right. It's this whole sort of setting us up with this 60-vote majority as if we really could just all agree on all kinds of things. I mean, there had just been these divisions all along. And so the whole notion of a coalition of Democrats is kind of what we perhaps should be looking for, and a coalition of people who are Republican and independent. So we've got to – I'm glad, hopefully, that this can result in breaking apart that dichotomy.
I think, Anthony, what we need to do is we need to put together a show just on what the rules of the Senate are.
That's right.
Because
I think
shifting.
That, as Bob said, I think that this is artificial. And as Dr. Washington said, ask Ben Nelson, ask Mary Landrieu, ask Blanche Lincoln. Mm-hmm. Are they going to stand with this president when he needs them to on these critical issues like health care? And they're not.
And the answer is no, because they come from red states.
That's
I
right.
mean, you can't get 60 Democrats, given the way the Senate works. You can't get to 60
the rules are very complicated.
Democrats without getting a lot of red state Democrats, because the little states, the small states which get the same two senators there, they tend to be conservative at this point in our history. And so the Senate tilts right. towards conservatives. It's a little bit lopsided.
And this was an arcane rule created in the 1700s to ensure that the United States became the United States and that small states could have some power in
right.
the face of the large states.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's where it came from. And we're still stuck with it.
I mean, when Bush and Gore had their dead heat, Bush won 29 states. Gore won 21. That's the way the math breaks down. When the country is evenly divided, the Senate tilts 58-42 Republican. It's a miracle the Democrats have 60. And to get 60, they have to have a lot of people from those red states. And they're not going to vote We saw that in the healthcare. They're not going to go along with the more progressive version of things. They can't. They will get defeated if they do.
And this gets into the kind of gaming of politics that he referenced when he's saying, like, every day is an election day. Mm. And it's like we're treating like every day is Super Bowl Sunday. and it's like every – and you can't govern that way, and we can't lead people that way. I mean, you have to deliberate. You have to take time. You have to negotiate. And, yeah, again, breaking apart this notion that, you know, we got here's Team Democrats and Team Republican, and we're against each other is going to continue to fail.
Let's go back to the phones. 410-319-8888. Mitchell, you're on the air.
I'm calling about the idea that the Republicans and the Democrats have good intentions, that we say they have different ideologies, but we all assume they have good intentions.
Mm.
Geithner was just on earlier that day, I believe, or the day before, and they were grilling him about AIG. And these people on Congress was grilling him about what he did, but they all are getting money from these corporations through lobbyists. And then you have the media that comes on and says, Geithner got grilled. And we all know that it was just a smokescreen, a joke, to say they did something. And then Obama comes up, and we have this idea that he has good intentions. But the reality is that we have a country of almost 300 million people, and we have two parties that both are accepting money from people for favors or whatever you want to call a lobbyist. We are delusional, and we need to wake up and realize that Obama is like every other politician, a part of, he's a corporate man, and he's going to do what a corporate man does. This is business. And we keep thinking that something real is happening, and the media perpetuates that. We all know what happened with Geithner was a joke. We know that these things are jokes. We need to wake up and see things as they are. Stop being delusional little children.
Mitchell, thank you.
I think one of the points that Mitchell makes is very valid, but I will tell you that a lot of the people, I shouldn't say left, but a lot of people on the left have begun to realize that Geithner and a lot of people around Barack Obama come from that Wall Street culture. And as much as there is this move to push Geithner out, Geithner's not going anywhere.
He was Bernanke. He just got voted.
That's right.
Again, for second term.
Isn't that
just
something?
Before he went on the air.
But Mark, the amazing thing about Bernanke is
70-30 was the vote.
If we were taking bets, if we were to believe all the rhetoric that was coming out of the Senate, out of the Republicans, out of even the Democrats, you would have assumed Bernanke's in trouble. And that Geithner, in fact, was in trouble. And I remember saying last week, they are fine. Bernanke's going to be reconfirmed. They're going to move forward because that culture really does dominate this White House.
And what you say, Anthony, what Mitchell says as well, I certainly agree that all these people around Obama are from that culture. And they were invited by Mr. Obama. And so we have to associate him with the culture as well. And so, as Mitchell says, when he gets in a speech and says stuff like, you know, nobody liked the bank bailouts. I hated it. You hated it. We hated it. No, you could have stopped it. You know. And then the anti-Wall Street statements he makes a little bit later in the speech as well. It's like, come on, Mr. President. You know, you can't speak from both sides of your mouth. It's either,
yes,
you know,
can.
We hated it. Well, you can, but it really falls flat to the ears of Mitchell and so many others who, you know, pick up on that stuff.
But I think that what I'm always shocked about is that people are shocked. You know, I mean, President Barack Obama as he said to the people last night of America, he said, I've never said I was anything but what I am and who I am and what I believe in. You know, that I'm somebody who believes in reconciliation. I'm somebody who believes in forgiveness. I'm somebody who believes in kind of an openness with the stuff. I'm not going to be the ideological man you want me to be. That's not who I am, is what he was saying to the American people. And I think that, you know, his closing statement was, I campaigned on the promise of change. Change we can believe in, the slogan went, he said. And right now, I know there are many Americans who aren't sure they still believe we can change or that I can deliver it.
But what he also said is that he's not going to quit. We have to not quit. We have to keep pushing it. And so his election, which I'm sure many of us in around this room was just the beginning of something. We still have congressional races. We have state races. We have local mayor. I mean, we have local school boards. I mean, it is a culture, and we have to break that corporate. I mean, it still is the military corporate industrial complex that we're operating in.
And I would maintain that no matter who was elected president of the United States of America in our last election, no matter who you voted for, Republican or Democrat, in the primaries, except for a couple, or in the general election, would have done things not very differently than Barack Obama when it comes to things like the bailout and other stuff. I mean, you know, it's I think Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, I don't think the difference would have been that great.
So then that leads us then to a discussion for another show, Mark, yes. about even looking at our body politic and looking at government and saying, you know, as we kind of jokingly said during one of the breaks, but this whole system is screwed up. I mean, this corporations and the influence and
but some of the problem is, I think, is that people Medea Benjamin said about Guantanamo. I said, you know, most people in America don't care about. They could care about Guantanamo. They can't even care about the troops coming home from Iraq. But Guantanamo is not even in the picture. They don't care about Guantanamo. They care about their jobs. Exactly. They care about their mortgages. They care about what's happening here on the ground, and that's where people are. You know, and the folks at MoveOn.org are demonstrating in front of Congressman's office about health care. Why are you doing that? People are thinking about their jobs right now and where this country is. He tried to speak to that last night, and the question is, the big question for Barack Obama's administration is, did that speech calm the people down to allow him to move in the direction he wants to take it?
We are so polarized. I think that, yes, I think he reconnected with a lot of people last night. But I think that a lot of the people needed to hear what he was saying, the challenges that he was making to both parties, the challenges he was really giving to us, I think people's ears were closed.
Let's try to get another quick caller in here, 410-319-8888-D. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. I want to quickly agree with Anthony McCarthy that he is, and his value is that he is he does analysis and does critique. What I would suggest is lacking is the articulation of issues around which activism can be mounted. We need the analysis. We need the critique. We need that stepping back and putting into a framework. I'm going to quickly remind you of, I think, something either of you said in an earlier broadcast. Lincoln had Frederick Douglass, Johnson had King, and it still remains to be seen who will have Barack Obama. I hope you're understanding what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
This is very wise because understanding and new frameworks do not come from elected officials. From wise people outside the government who don't have to go out and beg for votes. We do have two corporate parties, one a little more so than the other. New frameworks of understanding don't come. You can't expect anyone to be elected to office and then suddenly show up like the philosopher king and reinvent the way the country thinks about things. It just doesn't work that way, and the caller is very wise.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's especially important for us to remember here as we remember Howard Zinn, who passed away last night,
yes. Which
is what he would say if he was sitting on this show.
And I know you've mentioned that
I'm sorry.
You've got great topics.
So. I wish we had more time, but we are out of time. I want to thank Anthony McCarthy, of course, Dr. Mary Washington, Reverend Heber Brown, Bob Swanby for being here. Good to have you all in the studio. It was a great conversation. Thank you so much. WEA is looking for volunteers for our planning committee for the upcoming annual A Taste of WEAA celebration. If you're interested in volunteering for our planning committee, contact Norvell at 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. And I want you to join Healthcare for the Homeless for the Sweetest Night in Town. The 19th annual Chocolate Affair sample more than 50 of Baltimore's best restaurants, caterers, and chocolatiers while raising resources and awareness necessary to end homelessness. The Chocolate Affair is Thursday, February the 4th from 6 to 9:30 p.m. at M&T Bank Stadium. Tickets and more information are available at chocolateaffair.org. We're going to take a journey down to Westport. Stay with us. We'll be right back.